Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. I am thrilled and thankful to be here behind the microphone. I've never been mistaken for a leading man, so it's nice to be here. You know, they say that familiarity breeds contempt, which is why I'm always suspicious when somebody says, I'd like to get to know you better. I never know what to think about that. Anyway, now we've got the holiday season around the corner. We've got Thanksgiving this week, which I am frankly looking forward to. It's such a nice, pleasant holiday. I love the smells and the laughter and the sounds of Thanksgiving, because then all of a sudden you have to start being very careful not to get caught into the commercial push of Christmas and keep the main thing the main thing, which is the birth of Jesus. But certainly is a lot of pressure to get the right gift or to figure out what you're going to do for your kids or your grandkids. And certainly the toys have gotten a lot more elaborate and expensive because they probably want something in the electronics department. I remember my Christmas present, I would get that, you know, that bird that would dip its beak into the cup of water and then come back out. And I'd sit and watch that, you know, for days and days. And I thought, oh, that's so cool. And that's all it would do. And then you finally got to play a video game. It was called Pong. And that was like, this is like the most coolest game ever. And it was just like a little ball that would travel across the screen, and you would get that little cursor to try to keep it in play. And for some reason, that would entertain me for hours and hours and hours. And try to sell that to a kid today ain't going to work. All right. James K. A. Smith is an author and a very interesting man. I had a chance just a couple days ago to have a chat with him about his new book. And his new book is a third part of his trilogy, which would be make it the end of this trilogy. It's called Awaiting the King, Reforming Public Theology. He is a very interesting thinker. I'll take a short break and let you hear that interview in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I have on our studio line James K.A. Smith, author, professor from Calvin College, and I feel a little bit like Wayne and Garth getting backstage to a concert, talking to him. I'm not worthy. Jamie, welcome to the show.
It's great to be back with you.
Thank you so much. I find you so absolutely and utterly fascinating that I don't even know where to begin, although you do have a new book called Awaiting the King, Reforming Public Theology. My first question is, what is public theology?
It's a great question. I'm using the term public theology fairly generously to say thinking Christianly and theologically about our public lives.
I like that.
And in a big part of that, I think, is our political lives. But I prefer the term public theology to the narrower term political theology, because I think there are a lot of facets of our common life, our attempts to live together, that are certainly outside of the bounds of government, states, you know, politics, and yet they are shared. They're public. They're ways in which we're trying to forge lives together with our neighbors, and I'm trying to help folks think about that a little bit more robustly.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jamie, you say that public life is not a neutral space. Do I have that right?
Yeah. So part of what I'm inviting people to think about, and this is the third volume of a trilogy, so there's a long backstory to this, but basically it comes down to this. I'm trying to get people to realize that when we are engaged in our cultural lives, when we're engaged in public life, we're not stepping into some neutral space, that in fact our public lives are caught up in all kinds of rituals and rhythms and routines that I say function like liturgies. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is they're not just something that you do, they're doing something to you. And if we don't realize that, I think we can be very naive, and we end up very eager to sort of dive into public life or dive into political life, and we have all the best intentions, we have all the right ideas in our heads, and we're going to go transform the culture. But we don't realize that there's these sorts of formative rituals that already comprise that space, and the culture ends up transforming us because it's doing something to us.
Mm-hmm. That is such a profound thought, and I don't know quite what to ask next, but didn't Churchill say something to that effect about buildings? Or I think I oftentimes say
yeah.
that something to the effect that we create technology, then it turns around and recreates us.
Yeah, I think the Churchill quote is, "We shape the buildings that then shape us."
Yeah, that's
so.
That's
it's kind of an architectural point,
uh-huh.
and it's actually a great analogy, because I'm thinking about our public lives in terms of social architecture.
Okay,
and in that sense, so think of it this way: on the one hand, we are building institutions, systems, practices that help us to live together. But what we also have to realize is the institutions and practices that we create also end up doing something to us. And if we are naive and we don't recognize the kind of formative and sometimes deformative power of those public rituals and liturgies, we won't realize that we're being sort of co-opted on a level and a kind of unconsciously being conscripted into a rival version of the good life.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jamie, when you talk about rituals, I would love for you to say a little bit more about, you know, the repetition of rituals and how that can help get embedded into the bedrock of who you are, which is probably important to the formation, isn't it?
Absolutely. There is no formation without repetition.
Okay.
That's just like a baseline axiom. And we all know that. If you're a musician or a golfer or whatever it might be, we actually get this principle in all kinds of other areas of our lives. There is no formation without repetition.
Mm-hmm.
We, for some reason, we're a little bit allergic to it in our spiritual lives sometimes. But the culture certainly understands this. And so we get invited to repeat little micro routines, little micro rituals over and over and over again. And yet those micro rituals can have these macro implications because they have this sort of snowball effect. And they start shaping our identity, and we don't even realize it.
Mm-hmm. I had a guest on the show recently, and he was talking about a ritual they have at dinner where they will actually observe silence amongst the family for a period of time, for just silence and solitude. And he said the kids squirm with uncomfortableness, but he said it also gives them a chance to understand what solitude is and what silence is, because other than that, you go right back to your world of distraction.
I actually, that's so interesting, because I've been talking a lot to churches about how worship also needs to cultivate spaces of silence, just as a countercultural force to the incessant frenetic distraction that characterizes the constant chatter of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, if we can't foster something like that, we will never have a contemplative life. And that seems really crucial to a spiritual life. So, no, that's exactly right. We have to, on the one hand, I want us to recognize the public rituals that we maybe imagine are neutral and benign, but are actually doing something to us. But then I also, part of what I'm trying to do is help people to see this is why we do what we do as Christians when we worship, when we gather, because in a way it's a counterformative project, right? So this mm-hmm. is how we unlearn those other habits and we relearn kingdom-oriented habits.
Mm-hmm. I want to repeat something you said and then finish the thought. And you said public life is not a neutral space. You're either being formed into the people of God's kingdom or deformed into the earthly culture's worship. I don't know where you come up with these profound thoughts.
Well, mostly I steal them from St. Augustine.
Okay. That makes me feel better.
But I give him a footnote, so it's not really theft.
Okay.
Yeah, so what I'm inviting Christians to think about the way they move through the everyday, and then maybe especially the way we move through our political lives, and to realize that these aren't just neutral spaces, and that in some ways, even though we move into these realms and projects with the best of intentions and we know what we believe, if we don't realize that there are these cultural rituals at work on us sort of below the radar of our conscious awareness, we might not realize how much we are being assimilated to the culture. And now we end up looking like something other than the people of God who are hoping for kingdom come. And in a way, I'm trying to help people diagnose the extent or the dynamics of Christians' assimilation to the dominant culture. Mm-hmm. And that has many, many manifestations. But I think it's really important that we take stock of how that happens. It's not usually because somebody has convinced us with an argument to agree to a bad idea. Mm-hmm. It's more that we have sort of been practiced our way into a disordered love.
Yes, yes. Now, Jamie, you say that the church is already a political space. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, and that's very liable to be misunderstood.
I get that. That's why I was asking you nervously.
Right. So what I mean by that is the people of God are a people who are citizens of a heavenly city. They are subjects of a risen, coming king. They, there's a way in which if you read the scriptures with this lens in mind, you'll realize that kingdom language is political language. Now, it's not partisan language. It's not to be confused with party politics in some particular country. But it is saying that Christianity is not just a kind of private soul rescue religion that gives me this individual relationship, that the gospel calls me into a people. To be in Christ is to be part of a people who are looking for another country, as the book of Hebrews puts it, and mm-hmm. who pledge allegiance to a risen coming king. And so I'm saying that is actually my primary political identity, and it's from that centered kingdom-oriented identity that I then lean into the particulars and messiness of public life in whatever country I find myself at this moment.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking to James K.A. Smith. I'm doing, thankfully, most of the listening, and he's doing most of the talking, which I'm very grateful for. We'll take a little break when we come back. More with James K.A. Smith in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I'm talking to James K.A. Smith. He's a professor at Calvin College and written a number of books, the last one in a trilogy called Awaiting the King, Reforming Public Theology. And Jamie, I find this book and this conversation absolutely fascinating. Do you see our identities as Americans conflicting with our identities as believers?
They can, yes. And I guess I worry... There's something about – I should – full disclosure, I'm a Canadian immigrant to this country. So that might slightly affect the way I see this. But there is something so powerful about the mythology of America that it does seem to be something that is uniquely susceptible to becoming a primary identity rather than a penultimate identity, if that makes sense. So that I worry that I think the American experiment is an incredible endeavor to imagine what a good, just, healthy society looks like, right? So I think that the nature of the American experiment is about the best you could do in many, many ways, mm-hmm. although there are sort of original sins that characterize that project. On the other hand, there's a sense in which Americanism is a kind of devotion to which we are easily prone in such a way that my American identity could end up trumping my Christian identity. Mm-hmm. And that's what worries me. It's not an either or it's a ranking and ordering. And I think it's we get the ranking and ordering mixed up.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would say is the way we slide into an Americanism is not mostly because we are convinced by bad ideas. It's because these rituals capture us. So to go back to what we were talking about, in some ways, the little micro ritual of people every single day for 12 or 13 years of their lives pledging allegiance to the flag is almost like a kind of creed that people begin their day with. And then it's not surprising that that has this overwhelming formative power in our lives.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about your book, Awaiting the King. And I think if that's our goal as his people, what does that look like? I assume it's not a passive thing.
No, exactly. I really struggled with this title, and it's not just waiting, it's awaiting, and I kind of want that to sound active.
Uh-huh.
So that there
like
is
that.
A way, we're not just sitting around twiddling our thumbs, we're not indifferent to what's happening to our neighbors, what's happening to our society. We are called to care for it, to contribute to it, to be stewards of it. We're even called to hopefully in some small way kind of bend our societies more towards that heavenly city if we can.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't want to fall prey to a kind of activism where we think we bring about the kingdom. And I think that's a real cultural temptation. Our goal isn't to win, and our goal isn't to bring this about. We are to be caught up in what God is doing and learn how to pray, "Thy kingdom come," and to learn what it is to kind of wait in the meantime. I think our waiting will be characterized by a sort of holy impatience in that
mm-hmm.
sense.
I like that.
So it's not just passive, it's not just quietist, but it's also not triumphalist, and it's not trying to hurry things up on our timeline. We know that the king will, only the Father knows when the king is coming.
Mm-hmm. So, Jamie, how do we carry ourselves or present ourselves in this earthly city as we're awaiting the king?
Yeah, for me, a lot of it is about what sort of posture Christians should carry.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't really spend time in the book saying here's the policies and here's the positions that all Christians should agree on. But I do spend a lot of time saying I think the posture of Christians in our public lives should be one of patience and hope. I think one of the things that worries me most about Christian witness in public life today is how much of it seems to be driven by fear. And it just seems to me that if we are a people who trust in a coming king, fear is not what should characterize us. We shouldn't be a panicked people. We should be a people with a deep hope and trust and confidence that God is sovereign and that the king is coming and that he is faithful to us. And then show the world what a good, just, flourishing society looks like. I think the church should be like a little foretaste of that coming kingdom. It's like when Noah sent the dove out from the ark, and it came back with an olive branch, and that was a sign that the floodwaters were receding. And in a sense, we as the people of God in our churches should be embodying a sign of what that coming, just, flourishing creation looks like.
Mm-hmm. Jamie, I have to say you're one of the brightest people I have spoken to, and trust me, I can say that because I know a lot of dumb people.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Bill. Thanks so much.
And congratulations on your book. I'd love to have you back on just because I have a load more questions and we just don't have time. So if you wouldn't mind, we'd love to call you again for another chance to get more.
Let's do it.
Okay, thanks.
That
Jamie.
Sounds great.
Have a great day. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. All right, it's 31 minutes after the hour. We're going to take a very little news break, and then we're going to talk to Dr. David Aikman. I always look forward to that. He is so smart, and I learned so much, as you will too. We'll take a little break and be back. David Aikman at 20 minutes until the top of the hour. Twenty-five minutes until the top of the hour. Dr. David Aikman is just going to be with us in a few minutes. But until then, Neil Cole says when we put our faith in anything other than Jesus, it will always end up leaving us unfulfilled.
We put so much faith in behavior modification. And if you put your faith in something other than Christ, you will grow something other than Christ. And so we're not putting faith in the gospel. We're not putting faith in Christ. We're putting faith in our process, in our program, in our curriculum, in our opinions, in our behavior modification, in our moral stances. Well, that's not faith in Christ. And the results, the fruit shows, there's so little fruit to bear for that. And we come off as being proud, arrogant, stubborn people that are so narrow-minded they can look through a keyhole with both eyes. It just is not making a difference in the world.
If you want to hear more of that interview, it sounds awfully good. Go to myfaithradio.com. The author and founder of Church Multiplication Associates is a gentleman named Neil Cole. You can get that interview in its entirety there. We'll take a little break, and we have to go through about 9 levels of security to get to our foreign affairs correspondent, David Aikman. We're having a little trouble. We'll try to get him on the line in just a minute.
My name is Bond, James Bond.
That music, of course, belongs to Dr. David Aikman, our foreign affairs correspondent, connecting with us all the way from Bray, Ireland. Good morning, Dr. Aikman.
Good morning, Bill. Very nice to talk to you.
As it is for me to talk to you. You know, I've been interested in getting your perspective. I think it felt awfully good for President Trump to get out of the U.S. for a little while. I don't think he minded his Asia tour. But I'm really curious to get your take on how you thought it went. And what do you think happened, especially when it comes to the Chinese?
Okay. Well, I thought the tour went very well. I think Trump performed out of his strengths, which are in assessing equals, business equals, trade equals. He's really able to get into a very close relationship with the people he's dealing with. I think the reception he was given by his hosts in East Asia was really stunning. I mean, the Chinese totally rolled out the red carpet for him. And he gave them great face by publicly complimenting President Xi on his abilities. So I think that went down well. I think he did well in the Philippines, in Vietnam, and at the APEC and ASEAN conference. So I'm not surprised he enjoyed being there, and I think it's going to lay the grounds for future progress for American diplomacy in the area.
David, did that trip to Asia give him a little bump in his popularity poll?
It's hard to tell. I haven't seen any polls directly since he returned, but I imagine it couldn't have done him any harm, because even his political opponents must have conceded that he was actually rather well received in parts of the world where he wasn't familiar with everything.
Mm-hmm.
But he's learning on the job as far as coming to terms with diplomatic challenges in regions he has not previously been familiar with. But it remains to be seen whether what he discussed with China about trade actually becomes an improvement in U.S.-Chinese relations and helps towards the lessening of the U.S. deficit with China.
Mm-hmm. I found it sad that there was a comment made from Xi Jinping that basically Jesus won't save you, but he will. And Christians are told, to understand that Jesus is not going to drag you out of poverty or cure your illness, but the Chinese communist government will. So you should take down a picture of Christ and put up a photo of President Xi Jinping.
This is a very serious development in the ongoing ramping up of persecution of Christians in China, which started under Xi about 3 years ago. when they started destroying entire churches in Zhejiang province and removing the crosses from steeples on other churches in order to lessen the profile of Christianity in that part of China. And since then, the whole thing has developed into a ridiculous pastiche of a sort of deity cult of Xi. Xi is the head of the Chinese state. The Chinese state is going to solve all your problems, is going to provide a pension. So don't you put up a picture of Jesus there, because he's not going to save you from your earthly obligations. Well, of course, putting up a picture of Chairman Xi is complete idolatry to any serious Christian in the country. And I'm sorry for President Xi Jinping, because I think all tyrants who put up pictures of themselves in order to assert their power over a people eventually suffer from that kind of idolatry, because I don't think God likes it very much.
I don't know where China is on the persecution watch list, but I would imagine they're going to get bumped up a little bit with this statement.
I think China is already pretty high on most lists, open doors and so forth, as a serious violator, or at least to use the State Department bureaucracy terminology, a country of particular concern, which is a nice way of saying, hey guys, you're not meeting up to standards. Mm-hmm. And I think this just confirms people's suspicions that the Chinese political system is developing into a closed totalitarian system even more than before, and the effects are now going to be imposed on the religious community in China, which is a great shame for them and for everybody.
Mm-hmm. David, two of the words I seem to hear all the time nowadays are these two words, in chaos. So whatever word goes in front of that is what you hear quite often. Today, you can easily insert the word Zimbabwe in chaos, can't you?
Yes.
Tell our listeners what's going on there.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, the army, which is quite professional, although it has occasionally lent its muscle to imposing penalties on political opponents of Mugabe, the army really got outraged that the vice president to Mugabe was sacked from his job in order to make way for Mugabe's wife, Grace, to come in and therefore be the successor designate. And they suddenly decided, hey, guys, we don't want to be ruled by this former typist whose only claim to fame is that she caught Mugabe's eye decades ago when she was assisting him in the presidential office. And so they came in and rather cleverly told the world this is not a coup, when in fact it was, because we got the president and his family under close protection. Well, close protection meant that they couldn't actually operate in their usual autonomous and independent way. And the success of the army really convinced Mugabe's political party, ZANU, the Zambia African Nationalist Union, to basically fire him from the job as head of the party and give him an ultimatum, which has already passed, to resign and leave the country or actually be impeached. So I think we are now waiting for the process of impeachment to happen, which will probably begin quite soon.
Well, if you are a foreign affairs junkie and have a question for Dr. David Aikman, give us a call. We'd love to hear from you, 877-933-2484, or you can email me the question, bill@myfaithradio.com. It's 13 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and be back. 11 minutes until the top of the hour. I'm speaking to Dr. David Aikman, my foreign affairs correspondent. David, I appreciated your analysis on Zimbabwe, but let me just ask you maybe a very simple question. Help me understand why I should care.
Because Zimbabwe is a country that used to be the breadbasket of South Africa.
Okay.
And the food production was kept going because the farms, which were largely owned by white people, were very efficient and very productive. And then what happened is that in the 2000 decade, Mugabe said, oh, these white people have got to go. We're having a revolution that's really returning all the land to the blacks. So they invaded white farms, they murdered them, they tyrannized them and terrified them to flee to England or South Africa. The result, starvation and complete mismanagement of the Zimbabwe food system. So they went from bad to worse. Inflation in Zimbabwe is now at so many percent that somebody showed me a banknote a week ago that had $1 trillion as the denomination. So money is totally worthless. People find it very hard to eat and so forth. And if Zimbabwe fell into chaos, then a lot of the rest of the African continent might be dragged in as a result, and that's a very serious development.
David, talk about what's happening with the Saudis right now, speaking of chaos.
Well, of course, what is interesting is that the prince, the dauphin, as you might call him, to use a French term, the heir designate to King Abdullah, has been taking charge, cleaning up on corruption, and really trying to get a handle on the system, which is quite sort of dysfunctional in many ways because you have so many different ministries doing different things, and added to which Saudi Arabia is embroiled in a war in Yemen trying to defeat the Houthis, a Shiite minority group that with Iranian help took over the capital of Sana'a and became the government. So that war has been very costly and destructive for the Yemenis and has brought starvation conditions to much of Yemen. And this is a real serious issue.
David, I would like to get the latest wrinkle in Syria and the Russian relations. What is your perspective on that?
Well, Russia recently at the United Nations vetoed, which it has a right to do being a permanent member of the Security Council, a resolution to investigate the Syrian military's use of chemical weapons. This goes back to a very destructive chemical bomb attack on a region in Aleppo a few months ago, which was very recorded by foreign news teams with great fidelity. So there was a lot of detail. The question is, where did those chemical weapons come from? There was a vile poisonous gas used. And the only people in Syria basically who had control of chemical weapons was the Syrian government. Now, the rebels may have gotten hold of some of their own stuff, but basically the chemical bombs were dropped by Syrian aircraft. And the Russians, who regard themselves as the protectors of the Syrian regime, absolutely do not want to have the Syrian regime's actions exposed in public.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. David, I want to just sort of wrap up our time about, what can we be thankful for this week when it comes to the political process and what's going on around the world? How can we be thankful?
Well, I think we should be thankful that the United States is a free and still democratic society, that it has all kinds of problems, but most of them are being faced by the different authorities involved in a responsible way, and progress is being made. We are not at war with anybody, well, except the Islamic State terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States soldiers are not dying in places, except in a few spots where various foreign regimes have requested help in order to survive. And that, of course, includes Afghanistan and some regimes in Africa. So we should be very grateful that our society is reasonably healthy. The economy has been galloping along at a fantastic rate.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, since the Trump presidency began, it's increased at an annual rate of 3.2%, which is phenomenal, and it's unanticipated by anyone. So we have a lot to be thankful for. I think society is still largely governed by Judeo-Christian principles, although there is a strong move to strip those principles from key institutions and from issues like making abortion more readily available to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this current administration is doing its efforts to reverse the secularization that has been taking place over the previous few decades.
David, you're such a wise, kind man. I just love you. Thank you so much for being on the show, and happy Thanksgiving.
Well, Bill, thank you, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
All righty. Thank you. It's 4 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and then wrap up the show. Be back in a minute.
If you turn the volume up, you might be able to use the carpool lane. See? It pays to listen to the Early Morning Late Show with Bill Arnold on Faith Radio.
Thanks for listening to the show today, and thanks to Dr. David Aikman. Always a pleasure to have him on the show. And Adam Carrington and Patrick and James K.A. Smith. What a interesting guy he is. I want to leave you with something out of Psalm 95. It says, "For the Lord is the great God, the great King above all gods. In his hand are the depths of the earth, and the mountain peaks belong to him. The sea is his, for he made it, and his hands formed the dry land." That is the king I serve, who is in control. I hope you have a great day. I'm so glad you listened. See you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend, and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.